Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Another day, another tumble on Wall Street. We'll talk about that for a bit. We'll talk international trade as well and the Sundance Television Festival. See what I did there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 25th of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We've said it before. We'll say it again, I'm sure. The stock market is not the economy. The economy is not the market. Those markets do, however, affect the economy and those of us living and working in it. Same for companies. They watch stocks just like the rest of us, which, given the downdraft on Wall Street so far this year, brings us to this. We got word this morning that the industrial giants Johnson Controls and Tyco have decided to merge. It's another example of what are called inversions, sort of mergers plus relocations overseas, in this case to Ireland. Projected tax savings, by the way, is $150 million a year. This comes after what, let's all remember, was a record year for mergers and acquisitions in 2015. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with what lessons this deal teaches us in this so far bearish year of 2016.
When beef is on sale at the grocery store, it sells.
You want to buy something low, not when it's high.
Anant Sundaram is a professor at the Tuck School of Business. But when companies are on sale, like they are now, they do not sell so well when it comes to mergers and acquisitions. Companies, it turns out, are not beef. David King is professor of management at Iowa State.
People are essentially become more conservative.
In fact, there's a very predictable cycle to all this.
There's documented M&A wave.
Mergers and acquisitions surge and break records one year. The stock market crashes the next.
Almost one-to-one.
And after the market tanks, mergers and acquisitions fall off too. So again, when it's most expensive to buy, that's when all the buying happens. When it's cheapest to buy, not that much buying happens. Couple reasons for this.
A lot of companies use their stock to buy companies, so their stock is also depressed.
The company you want to buy might be cheap, but you might be poorer. There's also some psychological reasons for M&A drop-offs when the markets are bad.
How do you convince shareholders?
Donna Hittrich teaches finance at Columbia. You might want to snap up a company for a bargain, but it's really hard for a company to admit that it's now just a bargain. One final reason to expect M&As to drop is that it turns out that in one way, companies are like beef. Well, cows, really.
There's a lot of herd behavior.
The Tuck School's Anant Sundaram again. When nobody else is doing something, it's scarier to do.
People seek out the comfort in a crowd.
Now, if history is a guide, companies will realize there are good deals to be made, the best deals will get snatched up, and the herd will move on to the next feeding frenzy. Just probably not right now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of feeding frenzies, the epitaph for McDonald's has been written many times in the past couple of years. Stories about how nobody wanted what they were offering, we're all watching our diets, and how are they going to make money with a dollar menu anyway? Yeah, well, it shows what we all know. The turnaround effort at the Golden Arches is gaining some momentum. Sales at established U.S. stores jumped almost 6% at the end of last year, the best quarter for the company in nearly 4 years. All-day breakfast helped, yes, because Egg Muffin. But the company says it's still going to be a little while before turnaround becomes growth. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at some of the challenges McDonald's still faces.
The all-day Egg McMuffin has been a pretty good thing for McDonald's so far.
It exceeded our launch expectations.
That's Chief Executive Steve Easterbrook speaking on a conference call today. Easterbrook took the reins last spring after a couple years of worsening sales in the U.S. He's championed all-day breakfast, but also better food quality and accuracy and speed at the drive-thru, which had been rough spots.
All-day breakfast is understandably a more of a headline grabber, but we believe that building these other platforms of growth on top of that will keep us competitive in the marketplace.
McDonald's stock price went up on today's earnings news, but restaurant consultant Aaron Allen is skeptical of McDonald's path. He says franchisee sentiment is low, the menu at the Golden Arches is too sprawling, and fast food hamburger joints are not in a great spot.
U.S. hamburger consumption per capita is not increasing.
Plus, the fast food industry in general is going through changes. Here's restaurant industry analyst Bonnie Riggs at the NPD Group.
The millennials, who were the heaviest users of quick service places, have cut back dramatically on visiting restaurants.
Jefferies analyst Andy Barish says that does pose questions for McDonald's future.
Whether or not they can, you know, connect with this next generation of millennials and continue the performance, you know, medium to longer term is, you know, that's a question I don't think anyone can answer.
But for now, Barish says McDonald's is moving in the right direction. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as I mentioned, not so good. One never knows what the music will be, at least I don't. I do know, though, but it's not going to be flugelhorns. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Negotiators from the United States and the 11 other countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership get an all-expenses-paid trip to New Zealand next week. It's a signing ceremony for the deal that covers about a third of all global trade. Signing is the easy part, of course. Then it's up to the legislatures of member countries to do the ratifying. As part of that process, lawmakers are going to try and get a handle on what this agreement actually will and won't do. No easy task, given how much ground the thing covers. There are chapters on labor, the environment, e-commerce, sanitary and phytosanitary measures. You get the idea. So, how on earth does one go about figuring out how something this big and this complex nets out? One Economist has a new report out today with one answer to that question. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look.
Peter Petrie is, well, actually a little bit giddy.
This is truly exciting for geeks, but nobody else, I'm afraid.
He's in his office at Brandeis University in the suburbs of Boston, sitting in front of a laptop that holds an economic model of the potential impact of the TPP. He and a handful of colleagues spent the better part of last year getting the model ready and inputting the terms of the agreement in all its thousands of pages.
This is the red button that makes it all work.
A dramatic click of the mouse.
You can see it now running.
We watch a mess of characters and symbols begin to scroll past the screen. The computer's fan starts to whine.
It tells you that it has 108,000 rows and columns, which are equations and variables. It tells you that it has 1.18 million data points that are not zero in that column, and it's now solving it.
How does it do that? Well, it takes all sorts of data about the economies of the 12 TPP countries.
For example, that in order to make an automobile in Japan, you need this much steel and this much energy and this much rubber.
And then adds in the changes the TPP will make if it takes effect, like reductions in the taxes charged on stuff as it crosses borders.
Altogether, it's 5 million tariff lines.
There's also data on changes to rules and regulations that can make it difficult and costly for a company to operate abroad. Trying to estimate the impact of reducing those barriers is squishier, but they're in there too.
So we have about 100,000 simultaneous equations in the model.
And there are some things that aren't in the model. The TPP's proponents say it will rewrite rules for global trade. And while you can try and quantify the individual impact of different pieces of those rules, that mega impact, if it does succeed in that very lofty goal, Petrie says the model can't capture that.
It just ended.
So about 8 minutes after we hit that red button, the model's done. It creates a series of new files. Petrie opens a spreadsheet that shows how much the TPP will add to the size of each country's GDP and income by 2030. It shows Vietnam gets the biggest boost relative to the size of its economy. And for U.S. income?
Its effect from the TPP will be $131 billion. In that year and in every year thereafter, it raises income levels by that much. That's around 0.5%.
0.5%?
So 2030, if you look at incomes in 2030, they will be 0.5% higher than they would have been otherwise.
At which point you might be thinking, what? All this work for that?
Getting 0.5% in a huge economy like the U.S. economy at very modest investment. In other words, without spending the $1.5 trillion that one would normally spend to get that much extra income, is not bad.
So Petri is in favor of the TPP, but he wants to be clear. There are still some costs.
Workers have to move. You know, some people will lose their jobs and find places elsewhere in the economy. Overall, the places should be there, but that doesn't necessarily solve any one person's problem.
Petri says those job losses, about 50,000 in any given year, will be mostly in manufacturing that needs lots of labor. Textiles, apparel, some types of machine building. People who lose their jobs may have a tough time getting new ones. Maybe they'll have to retire early or take a wage cut. But over time, he thinks there'll be a roughly equal number of jobs created in other parts of manufacturing. Electronics, computers, in financial services, food processing. So those are the findings. But the trouble in trying to predict the future...
You know, the world will always unfold differently than what the models assume will take place.
Danny Rodrick is an economist at Harvard.
So in a way, you know, the modelers have a perfect cover.
Rodrick's written a newish book that looks at the strength and weaknesses of economic models. He says the strength for this type of model is that they can look at many different interactions across many different markets. Useful. But he doesn't want us to take them as gospel.
They give us a sense of precision that really doesn't belong there, because the fact is that there's going to be a lot of uncertainty about these numbers, even for things like the effects of tariff reductions, which we ought to have a better handle on.
Rodrick says the different ways researchers perceive trade can shape the models they use. In fact, a team at Tufts University recently released their own study based on different modeling. They estimate U.S. GDP would be 0.5% lower 10 years after the TPP takes effect.
I conjecture that if politicians didn't demand them, that the economists would actually not be producing these numbers. And I think what keeps them alive is much more the demand from politicians, lobbyists, various think tanks, and the media.
Yep, that's me. Rodrick says models can't give us the whole story on their own. He's written they're like a partial map that illuminates a fragment of the terrain. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The weather in Park City, Utah today is 29 degrees, partly cloudy with a chance of money movie deals and plenty of buzz. The 10-day indie movie extravaganza, otherwise known as the Sundance Film Festival, is about halfway through its run. And notice I said film festival. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports that given the growing number of television series showing up there, the festival might have to consider changing its name.
So who let all these TV people in? Here's Brian Steinberg at Variety.
The gradual evolution is being spurred in part by a bevy of new companies involved in streaming video, Netflix, Amazon, and the like, that are looking for original content.
They're not the only ones. HBO, CNN, the broadcast networks, they're looking too. For high-quality series, documentaries, edgy comedy, stuff that isn't getting bankrolled for the big screen but can hold audience on smaller screens. Entertainment author and blogger Jim Hill points to the Stephen King miniseries 11/22/63 about the JFK assassination that Hulu showed off at Sundance.
The concern at the studio level is because it was a period drama and kids today don't know JFK from LOL, you know, we're not making that movie. But on the other hand, from a Hulu's point of view, the fact that it was a complex story that couldn't be told in 2 hours of screen time, that made it ideal.
Or take Netflix's four-part documentary on comedian Chelsea Handler.
What do you think about sobriety? You
boring. Yeah. I am really my dog's like so judgmental.
Provocative for sure, and it doesn't hurt to have Sundance's stamp of approval. Media writer Stacey Kramer says there's more and more crossover these days in the film industry. And when you add in TV at a festival like Sundance,
you add this excitement level and this other pipeline of money and creativity.
And it's that pipeline that brings so many players to Sundance in the first place. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I was insane. I was addicted. It was a passion beyond control.
It was a book, a really old book. But first, let's do the numbers. Once again, wah-wah trombones, people. Pay attention later, I'll explain. The Dow Industrials, to the point at hand, off 208 points, 1.2%, closed at 15,885. The NASDAQ down 72 points, 1.5%, 4518. The S&P 500 declined 29 points, 1.5%, 18.77. We told you that all-day breakfast boosted McDonald's fourth quarter investors. Well, they went sunny side up, elevating the stock 0.6%. As for others in the breakfast game, Wendy's burned 2.6%. Dine Equity, which operates IHOP and Applebee's, shed 1% today. Oil prices down again today on news that Iraq had record production in December. And remember, they can sell it now. Brent crude settled at about $30 a barrel. WTI, West Texas Intermediate, $29 and change. Marathon Oil and Oil Energy Exploration and Production Company slipped 9.75% today. Chevron off 3.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.0% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Innovation is a fun, buzzy word to say, but it's pretty hard to actually do, right? That's especially true when the company you're trying to innovate at is big and old. That, however, is exactly what Beth Comstock has to do at GE General Electric. She was named Vice Chair for Innovation this past summer and has just released GE's 2016 Global Innovation Barometer. Beth, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Kai.
Without getting into, you know, proprietary details of what you and the corner office there at GE talk about, how do you use it? Because GE is, as everybody knows, a big, giant, not always, you know, agile company, right? So what do you guys do with this data?
Well, we look at it and we say, what lessons can we learn? You know, what's happening in what parts of the world? How might that impact how we think about it? Let's take, for example, several years ago, we were seeing a growing trend of Saudi Arabia being more open for innovation. And we were starting to see more of that in the country as well. We were doing more in health and energy. And I think just that finding alone allows you the confidence to say, hey, there's an open environment here. It allows us to go back to our partners and say, you know, a lot of folks in the market in this country are feeling the same way, that innovation is going to solve some of the problems. So let's dig in here.
You got this job as vice chair of business innovation, what, about a couple of three, 4 months ago? August, right?
Yeah, it was August, right.
So what do you do every day at a company like GE, which has 300,000 people, and you are in charge of innovation?
Well, the first thing you have to do is just constantly be asking yourself, you know, you have to be a bit paranoid. So you're just constantly asking yourself and the teams that I get to work with, what's next? Where do we need to be? You know, just constantly surveying the marketplace. You have to go to where change is happening. And then the third thing you have to do is create the mechanisms to try some things out. And so we, in our lighting business, which is GE's oldest business, I mean, you think of Thomas Edison,
sure,
the light bulb, that's
yeah,
how GE got its start. One of the great things our lighting team did is they incubated an LED business. And thank goodness they did, because now we're able to quickly scale up and launch a new business, the first of its kind out of a 100-year-old business.
So before we chatted, I went to GE's corporate biography site, obviously, to look you up and you know, inform myself. And right there on the landing page is a big picture of Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE. But there's this quote that I want to read to you and get your take on it. This is Jeff Immelt, your boss. He says, "We are transforming GE into the world's premier digital industrial company." What does that mean? Because this is a time for change of GE. You guys have been doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, if you've been following GE, if anyone follows GE regularly, you would say that 2015 was probably one of the biggest years of change the company's seen, certainly in a decade. And it's all about focusing more on our industrial roots. But the big change for us was also embracing digital in the way we have. And when we talk about digital industrial, for us, it's the industrial internet. How do you connect all of the great technology we make to the internet? Why do you want to do that? Because when you start getting data, you can analyze it, you can start to understand how machines work better, and over time, not only make them work better, but make the businesses that use them better. That's exciting.
Since you brought up the location thing, the news out of GE the last, 10 days, 2 weeks, is that company headquarters is moving to Boston, not Silicon Valley, but Silicon Alley, a hotbed, really, of innovation, and that's what Immelt said in his announcement. with that in mind, what does GE look like in Boston, say, 10 years from now? What is this company going to look like?
Well, I think you're seeing GE over the past decade be a much more distributed company with nodes around the globe. So I think in Boston, you'll see nodes of software, nodes of new kinds of businesses. When we announced it, we talked about creating and expanding efforts like life sciences, which is a hot area in Boston, robotics. We've actually partnered with a number of robotics companies doing a lot in our labs. We see Boston as a good space for that. So I think you'll see kind of a core leadership team, but a lot of new models being incubated and tested out in the Boston market.
Beth Comstock is a vice chair at General Electric. We were talking about the company's new global innovation barometer. Thanks very much, Beth.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for the time.
Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland, Oregon, has on its shelves about a million new and used titles. But there is one book that almost nobody, including the store's staff, is allowed to see. It's locked away in an undisclosed location, and the independent bookseller only brings it out for the most serious potential buyers. Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Rossman got a peek, though, at Powell's most expensive book.
It's not too hard to find what you need inside of Powell's City of Books. That's saying something about a store that engulfs a city block. You just learn to rely on the staff. But when I asked three different employees for the location of the store's most expensive book, I got three different answers.
Well, you know, we're not just going to draw you a map and say to somebody here, if you want it, come and get it.
Michael Powell is the former president of the family-owned store and man behind that book's purchase. In a room located in a place I'm not allowed to talk about, he carefully takes out two weathered volumes from bubble wrap. It's the 1814 Lewis and Clark Journal, published 8 years after the explorer's return. It costs $350,000.
This version is extremely rare, apart from being in really fine shape. Has the map, which I will not unfold.
He says one tear in that map could potentially cut the price in half. It's not a risk he's willing to take on a journalist. The value of this rare book means hardly any customers or employees will ever see it. But its presence is still significant to the store.
People are always asking us what's our rarest book. And so it's fun to say it's an edition of the Lewis and Clark Journals as opposed to, say, a 15th century German religious tract or something.
There are two big factors contributing to the steep price tag. The first, that map Powell mentioned, Captain Clark's map of the West. What makes the Powell's copy so expensive is not only that it includes this map and the original covering, but that it's in terrific condition.
The journals themselves with the map is just a very rare historical document.
John Logan Allen is a Lewis and Clark scholar and author based in Wyoming. He says initially about 1,500 sets were sold.
Most of them were probably destroyed, so there simply aren't many existing copies.
But is it $350,000 rare?
Frankly, I'm surprised that Powell has put this kind of price tag on it. I'm just not certain it's worth the money.
But you never know what it might be worth to a devoted Lewis and Clark collector. And they're out there, people like Roger Wunlick, who once spent years seeking Lewis and Clark printed materials.
I was insane. I was addicted. It was a passion beyond control.
For a blue-collar construction worker from Portland, that became a problem.
I had 11 credit cards at that time, and they were all maxed. I had refinanced my house twice.
Wunlick bought a copy of the 1814 Journal, like the one at Powell's, on a handshake. He paid for it in monthly installments. Eventually, he parted with it and the rest of his collection in a deal with Lewis and Clark College as part of a half-sell, half-donation. He estimates that book is now worth around $200,000. Michael Powell may have set a high price for his copy because he isn't really angling to sell. After all, they're part of Oregon history. But business is business. And Powell says the set is very much for sale.
Somebody said, wouldn't you feel bad? And I said, well, that price would heal a lot of wounds.
Powell wraps up the journal and locks it back in the safe where it'll sit until a buyer comes to the secret room. And if that buyer is serious enough, he might even unfold the map. In Portland, I'm John Rossman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, vindication of a sort. You remember last week when I said I'd had some listeners complaining that what I call the wah-wah trombones weren't really trombones at all, that they could in fact be flugelhorns? I'm pleased to say response has been overwhelmingly in my favor. Not only can't apparently flugelhorns or trumpets do the what's called a glissando, the slide between notes the trombones can, but apparently the notes are a hair too low for flugelhorns to begin with. So the defense rests on this one now and forever, but about those mandolins. All right, we got to get while the getting's good. The Dow off 208 points today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ down 72 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500, 29 points lower at the bell, 1.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bonder, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.